Radio Free Thinker. This week, the origins of hashtag Black Lives Matter, the racial divide, and systemic racism. Let's begin episode 306.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the space, the stars, our other sun has traveled this way before. There is much to be done.
Hello and welcome to Zion, your skeptical philosopher and scientist. This looks a little different. As a socially conscious person, I'm following the racial tension south of the border, as well as the focal point of this active resistance to systemic and institutional racism that's coalesced around the simple phrase, Black Lives Matter. Now, for some of you, this may shock, but I'm not a person of color. I'm about as white as it gets, really. So, I've been kind of wanting to do a show about this issue, but I've been worried that, well, it might come across as white-splaining. Or worse yet, I might get something wrong. So I've collected a set of clips from other shows of people who I think have done a better job than I could have, at least on this issue, and I'm presenting them here. Now, some of you might say that black racism is an American thing. And sure, we might not treat African Canadians as complete equals, but there's no KKK in Canada. Well, there actually was a KKK North, and there are white supremacists here. So let's not feel too righteous on this whole black racism thing. But that's not why I'm presenting this, or at least I have an ulterior motive. We do have a severe, radical, systemic, and institutional racism going on here in Canada. We've just chosen a group of a different color to host our racism. We focus on First Nations people. So before we get on our high horse, if we play a little game, every time that they say black, you substitute native. Well, you'll get the point that I'm making. We're just as bad, maybe some ways worse, if not different, than they are down there. And in a small way, I kind of hope this helps. So let's just listen in, and well, for what will be obvious reasons at the end, let me instead this week start with reminding everyone, eyes open, minds on.
Today, we're going to try to answer a question. Why Black Lives Matter? Why that slogan? Black Lives Matter seems so obviously true, so self-evident, that at first it seems incredibly weak. Like, who wouldn't agree with that? And yet, to some ears, typically white ears, it sounds insulting, as in, who are you to accuse me of thinking black lives don't matter? And for some people, apparently, it sounds like the protesters are saying that lives that aren't black don't matter.
Everyone's been saying black lives matter, and they do, but all lives matter.
Saying black lives matter imply that white lives don't, correct?
Why does black life only matter?
Those clips were from Fox News, and Glenn Beck, who used to be on Fox News. Needless to say, all of those people don't get it. But if you do want to get it, you actually have to go right to the moment when Black Lives Matter started and then trace the whole arc of the movement that Black Lives Matter has come to represent. Today, we're going to hear the whole story from the inside of how it began, why it blew up, why it matters, why Black Lives Matter matters, directly from the woman who created it, Alicia Garza, who coined the phrase and who co-founded the organizing campaign that helped spawn this movement in the first place. Why Black Lives Matter emerged as the uniting rallying cry for the political igniting of a rising generation, that is the story today. You can type in a phrase and see a little graph of how much people searched for it over time. And if you search for Black Lives Matter, what you see is a graph that's basically a flat line, nothing happening, and then a couple of little bumps, and then a huge spike, like almost straight up, in November 2014, after the grand jury failed to indict the police officers who killed Michael Brown and then Eric Garner. That's when most people heard about it. But in fact, the phrase was actually invented a lot earlier, on July 13th, 2013, the day that a different jury handed down its decision in a different case.
I remember that I was actually waiting for the verdict to come down.
This is Alicia Garza, today's guest. She's an organizer and activist based in Oakland, California.
And that particular day, I was at a bar with a friend, and we were having drinks and, you know, speculating about what we thought the verdict might be, what we thought the outcome might be.
In the Circuit Court of the 18th Judicial Circuit in and for Seminole County, Florida, State of Florida versus George Zimmerman, verdict, we the jury find George Zimmerman not guilty. So say we all, four person.
It just got quiet. It felt like we all collectively felt a gut punch.
I mean, ladies, I'm sorry. As your juror number...
I started thinking about my baby brother, and he's not really a baby anymore. He's 25, just one of the sweetest people you would ever meet. And he lives in a predominantly white suburban community, and he's a 6-foot-tall black man. And Trayvon could have been my brother. You know, I remember also feeling enraged and really profoundly sad. When I looked around me, there were a lot of other black people around me. I was seeing almost like our collective shape just feel really defeated. So I'm sitting next to 4 or 5 other people, and we're all on our phones, and we're, you know, interacting online, but we're also interacting with each other.
And this is at the bar?
This is at the bar, yeah. You know, I spend a lot of time on Facebook, like many other people my age.
Like all of us, yeah.
And I was scrolling through my timeline to see what my community was saying. There was a lot of kind of speculation about what did Trayvon do in order to put himself into a position of danger, rather than a more fundamental question, right, which is what could push someone like George Zimmerman to kill a 16-year-old child.
Juror B-76, is this your verdict?
Yes.
Juror B-37, is this your verdict?
Yes.
You know, folks saying things like, well, we knew that this justice system was never going to provide justice for Trayvon, and that's just kind of the way it is. And so what we need to do is X, Y, and Z. You know, we need better parenting in black communities. We need more education. But all of those responses were really attacking black people as if we have some kind of pathology. So I'm sitting there with friends, and we're talking, and you know, I just started saying stuff on Facebook, and one of the things that I said was, it's really important for us as a community to stop pathologizing ourselves and to really investigate what are the conditions under which these things can happen. You know, black people, I love us, I love you, we matter, black lives matter. And my close friend, Patrice Cullors, she was also online at the same time, and she saw that, and she reposted it and shared it, and then she put a hashtag in front of it.
The story of how that phrase went from Alicia's Facebook wall to the front pages of newspapers and network TV all over the country is pretty amazing. But before we get to it, I want to touch on this point that Alicia made when we talked to her. To overgeneralize a bit, white people have a tendency to assume that the phrase Black Lives Matter is addressed to them, either in general or to police officers specifically. That's definitely not how it began.
This really did start as a love letter to black people. And it was really a cry for us to say, let's stop self-pathologizing and let's start getting active together in our own defense and in support of each other. What is also true about Black Lives Matter is that it is a call more broadly to our society, and it's really a counterpoint to systemic racism, which is rooted in anti-blackness. This isn't about people being mean to each other. There are many instances of prejudice, and that's not what we're fighting. What we're talking about is the multiple ways in which black communities are at the losing end of almost every disparity that you can think of, whether it's employment, whether it's wages, whether it's level of organization, whether it's related to questions of gender in the workplace, whether it's related to health access, education, anything you can think of, black folks are at the losing end.
For Garza, the murder of Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of George Zimmerman wasn't about racism at the individual level. It wasn't about what was going through George Zimmerman's mind. It was about all the layers and decades of injustice that made that moment, the moment that Zimmerman moved his finger a tiny bit and killed Trayvon Martin, that made that moment possible. And she saw those layers in an extraordinarily vivid way because of something that had happened to her as a preteen.
I grew up in San Rafael in the Canal District, which is a very low-income, mostly black and brown area in Marin County. Went to elementary school there, and I do remember actually changing schools when I was in sixth grade and moving to Tiburon, one of the wealthiest towns in the entire world. I was one of maybe three or four black students in the entire school. We had ski week, which I had never heard of before I got there, which which is, you know, a week off so that parents can take their families skiing, right? And they don't have to miss school.
Like, it sounds like you just went from one world to another.
I did. I absolutely did.
After years of struggling financially, Alicia's parents had found their footing with a small business selling antiques.
In seventh grade, in this new school, in history class, we had to do some show and tell. And, you know, my dad thought it would be really cool if I brought a bayonet from the Revolutionary War to history class. And everybody else thought that was real cool. But when...
That is real cool.
Now that I think back on it, I'm like, I can't believe I brought a bayonet to school and, like, lived to tell the story, right? Especially in the current conditions.
That happens when you go to, like, a rich white school.
Totally, right? But if I had done that at the school that I came from, you know, it would have been bad news for me. The experience of those two disparities really solidified for me that there are some things underneath why some people have and some people don't.
This realization of the impact of social structures on the lives of individuals is something a lot of people don't see. It's something a lot of powerful people don't want us to see. Listen to this speech that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker gave at a conservative conference a few weeks ago.
In America, the opportunity is equal for each and every one of us. But in America, the ultimate outcome is up to each and every one of us individually.
Starting in middle school, Alicia knew that this just wasn't true.
It wasn't actually about your skill or how hard you worked, right? Some of it was just about the family that you grew up in and the access that you have. Mostly it's about the chances that you get in life that are based on gender. They're based on your race. They're based on your nationality. And that, you know, I learned over time that there's things that we can do about that. My parents were like, I want you to be a lawyer or an award-winning writer. And so I always joke with people and say that my parents were grooming me to be Condoleezza Rice. And then at some point I defected, right, and said, no, that's not the path for me.
After college, Alicia became a community organizer in Oakland, going door-to-door and working with low-income families. By 2013, she was in the job she holds today, the Special Projects Coordinator for the National Domestic Workers Alliance. And by the way, that is an amazing group. You can hear their whole story on The Good Fight, episode 17, at thegoodfight.fm/17, featuring the amazing Ai-Jen Poo, who just published a terrific book and who put us in touch with Alicia. Thank you, Ai-Jen. Anyway, back to the story. Alicia and her co-founders didn't just come up with the phrase Black Lives Matter. They came up with a whole campaign and built a community, online and off, that helped drive activism across the country.
Patrice and her team actually did a protest into Beverly Hills on Rodeo Drive, and they brought signs and banners that said Black Lives Matter, and they were really beautiful, incredible images. And then, of course, we saw how in Brooklyn, there were thousands of people who marched across the Brooklyn Bridge carrying signs that said Black Lives Matter. And, you know, a couple of weeks later, we actually saw a episode of Law & Order, SVU, which is one of my favorite shows, I confess. They did a mashup of what happened with Paula Deen and the case of Trayvon Martin, and there's a protest scene, and the images in the protest are all Black Lives Matter.
No justice, no peace, no justice.
Kid was just a kid in a hoodie, wrong place, wrong time,
wrong skin.
When something shows up on a Law & Order episode, you know it's entered the national conversation. But Black Lives Matter didn't stay there. As time passed, most of the national media moved on. And then, in August, Ferguson exploded.
I remember that evening, I believe, turning on the news after Michael Brown was killed, seeing the National Guard and seeing the tear gas and seeing police in riot gear. And I remember just kind of staring at my television and going, what is happening? Why does this look like a war zone? Why does this look like Baghdad? This is, you know, I had to even look up, where is Ferguson, right? Nobody knew. I don't know if you knew, but I surely didn't know where Ferguson, Missouri was.
I definitely didn't know, no.
The idea that came up was to do a freedom ride to Ferguson. 500 black folks, journalists and bloggers and medics, attorneys, organizers, and then some folks are just people who have never been involved in activism before. When I arrived, people were exhausted and really traumatized. It's no small thing that people were having tear gas canisters thrown at them, that folks were being chased by police in riot gear with huge guns. That's not a small thing, and that's not something that you shake off. I heard officers calling people on the street niggers. I saw officers wearing I Am Darren Wilson wristbands. I saw officers snickering and laughing about the fact that a child was killed.
We propose that white supremacy is that in order to combat white supremacy, you need, in addition to all of the good police reforms that are being proposed by Ferguson Action and Justice League and all of the Black Lives Matter groups, that you also need to have an economic program. Basically, we lay out the reason why we think that, and I want to just highlight a passage that Michael brought to the piece, which I think is really wonderful. He notes that, like, at the inception of the enslavement, the institutionalized enslavement of African slaves, like that this was done for practical rather than bigoted reasons. You know, like you might think like it was just white folks hated people with black skin and so they enslaved them or whatever. But actually it was, you know, they couldn't enslave Western Europeans because they, you know, had the language skills and the social customs necessary to enter into contracts, which enslaved Africans didn't have, the, you know, custom barriers, language barriers. They couldn't enter into contracts. They were much more readily enslavable. And also white folks couldn't enslave the indigenous population because they were familiar with the terrain and could just run away, unlike enslaved and imported Africans. So there was a practical reason to enslave Africans for the early American forefathers. So the racist rationale, that like ideology of race and racism and white supremacy, then was sort of backformed to justify this material inequality. And we go a lot into Racecraft by Barbara and Karen Fields, which is a book I've talked about a number of times on this program, which basically lays out how we created this biological fiction called race in order to explain black people's inferiority, like inferior social situation in the United States, people who opposed and people who supported slavery around the Revolutionary era, attributed this enslavement of black people to their racial incapacity, conceived of race as like a scientific difference, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So because the economic exploitation is the reason for which to create an ideology of race and racism, we argue, Michael and I, that you have to institute a program that you have to institute an economic program in order to like eliminate white supremacy's reason for being and reason for continual reinforcement. And the program that we propose is one that won't surprise listeners of Discon because it's the same kind of stuff that we always talk about here. It's a full employment program based on a job guarantee and a basic income. I should shout out a fact that I learned when researching this piece. I'm going to have you guess, Alexis, if you can, the unemployment rate for black teenage high school dropouts from wealth-poor families. What do you think the unemployment rate for that sort of person is in the U.S.?
Does that count or not count people who are incarcerated?
I think it does not count those people.
30%. 95%. What?
95% of those people are unemployed. So that's a totally, totally bonkers fact. And it just goes to show that, like, we need better than the, like, usual stimulus things that like, even at the height of the Clinton boom, we had, like, almost 4% unemployment. And, like, who are the millions of people who remain unemployed even when we're at peak boom? That's who it is. Like, the people at the very back of the employment line, the least employed, least employable people. So that's why we need a full, true full employment strategy with carried out by a pairing of a job guarantee and a basic income. We also advocate for a land value tax to address all of the ways in which, like, land market speculation has instituted white supremacy, you know, white flight, racially exclusive suburban residential development charters, redlining, gentrification, the predatory lending that fueled the housing bubble and wound up stealing 53% of all black wealth, like the majority of black wealth just canceled, evaporated. So those are the first two things, and the last one is baby bonds, which I don't know if we've talked about in this program. I think we did when we had on Sandy Darity. Sandy Darity's at Duke University, and Derek Hamilton, his sort of partner in crime, is at the New School University, and they proposed a baby bond program because reparations, they say, is not politically feasible. It's just not, like, the politics around it are prohibitive. And Michael and I say that we support a program of reparations payments, but that if that is politically impossible, we should do these baby bonds. And really quickly, what a baby bond is a trust fund granted to a newborn infant who can't be, even if you want to blame adults for being in poverty and say that that's their failing, you can't blame an infant for being born into poverty. So it targets them, gives them a trust fund at birth that matures, and they can get the money when they're 18. Every baby born into a wealth poor family, that is to say below median or wealth position, would get a trust fund. The farther below median your family's wealth position is, the bigger the trust fund. So the lowest quartile of newborn infants in wealth position would get like $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund that they could get when they were 18. And Darity and Hamilton estimate that this could close the racial wealth gap in 2 to 3 generations. So that's like, you know, 40 years or something like that. It's not as good as it would be with a straight reparations program, but if it would close the racial wealth gap, it would do an awful lot of good.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
Use the term driving while black while talking about possible sources of discrimination and how the police go about their business, and you will probably face opposition from those who can't accept that there is any racial animus or bias that influences how the police go about their day-to-day jobs. But not only is it actually true of the day-to-day realities of many black Americans, but new data shows that it's actually getting worse over time. So this information is generated by the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill. They analyzed 1.3 million traffic stops in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. And what you're seeing there is the racial difference between the likelihood that you'll be searched when stopped between whites and blacks. And you see that you're already far more likely back in 2002, 13 years ago, you have something like a 60-70% higher chance of being searched if you're black. And that has steadily gone up over time. Something like 3 times more likely to be searched if you are black in 2013 than if you are white. And so this is something that we still have to defend every time you bring up that term, that you're more likely if you're a minority to be stopped, to be searched, to be charged with a crime, to be convicted of a crime. And it's actually getting worse over time.
But we live in a post-racial society. Mm-hmm. We don't see color. I mean,
it's technically true. Post-racial in that you can't talk about it.
Right.
No, it doesn't matter.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it just shows the gross over-policing. I mean, you cannot tell me that we do not have an institutionalized racist justice system here. And, you know, it's a stop and frisk thing, too. And when people say all lives matter, it's like, yes, they do. But this is a movement about Black Lives Matter for a very good reason, because black people are like 8 times more likely to be gunned gunned down by a police officer than a white person. And this just exemplifies that point. It's so sad. I mean, being pulled over just because you're black.
Yeah. We did elect a black president, though.
Right.
That's true.
So
racism is over.
Really a problem?
You win some, you lose some.
Yeah. I mean, you can go into specific issues like marijuana usage, right? And you can compare blacks and whites and then try to figure out who gets arrested more for the exact same crime. Black individuals, white individuals use marijuana at similar rates, although black people are criminalized or prosecuted at four times the rate of white people. Why is that? Okay, so people will make the argument, oh yeah, well, black people get pulled over more often because, you know, they're usually doing things wrong all the time. It's white people that don't do anything wrong. That's not true. Mm. You can compare them in specific crimes, if you consider possession of marijuana a crime, and you see a double standard there, the two-tier justice system. It's a huge issue, and yes, it has a lot to do with your skin color, but it also has a lot to do with your socioeconomic status. If you come from a certain background, regardless of what your skin color is, the law will come down very hard on you. If you're wealthy and you're the child of wealthy parents, well, you can use a defense like affluenza and get away with murder. So these are the kinds of things that drive me crazy when you do a story about police brutality and you bring up the issue of race and then you have people denying that something like white privilege exists. White privilege definitely exists. It's called benefit of the doubt. White people get it, black people don't, and it's unfortunate to say the least.
I just hate that they look at it in a vacuum, and they're like, black people just commit more crimes. You're like, I'm sorry, are you living in reality? Like, have you ever been outside the suburbs? Obviously, police are, you know, like you just said, socioeconomics plays the biggest factor in this. Obviously, cops are going to over-police these areas more. It's just completely absurd.
Now, you brought up sort of the different types of crimes. Let's talk about percent difference likelihood of being searched by type of stop. So the violation that supposedly they're getting pulled over for. You're seeing there, apparently, black Americans slightly less likely to be searched for driving impaired than white. That's interesting. But in all other cases, you see a large percent difference, including that if you get pulled over because you apparently don't have a seatbelt on, properly secured, as they say, you've almost four times the chance of being searched as a result of that. And for the crazy person that sees this and thinks, well, you know, they commit more crimes, What about them not wearing a seatbelt is so much more, threatening to the cops? Like, so, it's not like that's off and they're growling at the time. It's just that they don't have a seatbelt on.
So I love that stat, not because I think it's a good thing, but because I think that it perfectly demonstrates exactly what I'm referring to when it comes to white privilege. So if you're a white person driving around without a seatbelt, cop gives you the benefit of the doubt. Right. You get away with it a lot of times, right? He's not going to pull you over and start asking questions. If you're black, well, you know, you might be a little more suspicious, so they're going to pull you over because they want to ask questions.
Or it's just an excuse.
Exactly. So that's exactly what people refer to as white privilege. It doesn't mean that you as a white person are doing something wrong. It has to do with stereotypes and how much we've internalized them, whether consciously or subconsciously.
Yeah. Right, and it also bleeds into the workforce as well. Like, they've done studies that show if you have a resume, and it's the exact same resume, but if you have, like, a black-sounding name, you're way less likely to be hired. So this is across all aspects of society. But then you have laws that justify these extrajudicial assassinations on the street because they're saying, look, if you feared for your life, you can kill this person.
Right.
And if a cop is racist, even those cops in San Francisco said you could put an animal down, and that's a multicultural city that is full of different ethnicities.
Like that, Fox News likes to talk about it as this bastion of liberalism on the West Coast.
Right.
But apparently still some incredible racism there.
Absolutely.
A woman by the name of Tanette Powell wrote a piece in the Washington Post about how her two sons collectively have been suspended eight times. Now, keep in mind that her sons are 3 and 4 years old, Joa and JJ. Here's what she had to write about it. Joa had hit a staff member on the arm. After that incident, they deemed him a danger to the staff. Joa was suspended a total of 5 times. In 2014, my children have received 8 suspensions. Now, keep in mind that Joa is only 3 years old and JJ is 4 years old. They're literally in preschool. And while what they did was wrong, they've already been suspended so many times. And she sees this as a really big problem. Now, she gets together with a lot of the parents that also take their children to that preschool. And she noticed something really interesting She noticed that the parents who have white kids don't really experience the same type of treatment when it comes to the suspensions. Black children represent 18% of preschool enrollment, but make up 48% of preschool children receiving more than one out-of-school suspension. And that's according to a study released by the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights in March.
So let's stop right there, because that's a stunning fact, right? Now, a lot of times, people who are more inclined towards believing it's black people's fault will take a look at crime figures and go, you see that? Well, they get arrested more. That's because they're more likely to be criminal. They're more likely to be violent, etc. Now, this is a great example because it's three-year-olds. Nobody's more likely to do anything, right? And so it's not like three-year-old black kids. I mean, you'd have to be a real dyed-in-the-wool racist to think that three-year-old black kids are more violent than three-year-old white kids or Asian kids. They're all kids. They haven't even learned anything yet, right? We haven't been able to socialize them to eat their food right, let alone socializing them in a positive way or in a negative way, in a significant way. Anybody who's had a three-year-old knows how hard it is to control them, right? So it's normal. It's normal. But what do you have? You have black kids being punished in a massively disproportionate way because of stereotypes that's in the heads of the people who are punishing them. Right. It's not the kids, it's the assumptions about the kids from the adults. I think it's devastating.
Yeah, and it's more a subconscious thing than anything. I don't think that anyone is being like overtly racist in this case. Sure, there might be some isolated incidents, but you kind of have to step back and think about the stereotypes and the perceptions that you have about certain groups of people. And I think that Tunette Powell did a really good job in clarifying that in her piece, which you guys should check out in the Washington Post. But another thing that I would say is, you know, the ACLU has been on this topic for a number of years now, and it's the issue of the school to prison pipeline. I don't care what the race of the child is, right? When they're in preschool, when you're dealing with three-year-olds and four-year-olds, you shouldn't deal with it by just suspending them. They're children. They don't understand what they're doing. You're supposed to use that as a teachable moment. By handling it by kicking them out of school for a few days, you're not really accomplishing much. And I get it. Teachers have a really difficult job because they're dealing with all these kids. They're underpaid. And so keeping control of all of them can be very, very difficult. But we have these knee-jerk reactions where we think it's better to either throw them out of school for a number of days or kick them out of the school entirely. And with the school to prison pipeline, now all of a sudden we're actually criminalizing rambunctious behavior and putting them in juvenile detention centers.
So now if you think that it's that subtle discrimination that we're not even aware of, or as Anna's point, I don't think it's malicious, is a factor. Get a load of a study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. They asked mostly white female undergrads to judge kids and their actions. And they had black kids, Latino kids, white kids, okay? The black kids, on average, were judged to be older and less innocent than the white kids and the Latino kids. And they're just showing photos here, and they consider them to be more culpable for their actions, okay? Mm-hmm. And here's another stunner. On average, they thought the black kids were 4.5 years older than they actually were. Because why? Because the older you are, the more culpable you are, right? The more like, oh, he did it on purpose. Mm-hmm. So it makes your discrimination, it rationalizes your discrimination. Well, I mean, it's not a three-year-old, it's a 7.5-year-old. So he knew what he was doing. See, he's more violent, right? Or he takes more physical action, etc. So, I mean, look, and then when people say, no, there's no racism in the country, it doesn't mean we can't get beyond it, right? And the person writing the piece is very successful. She got beyond it, even though she dealt with similar issues, she says, in preschool against her, right? But it creates this huge hole that you're in from preschool, yes, from when you're three. And what you do is you internalize it. She made another great point in the piece. She's like, I thought I was the bad guy. I internalize it, and I was like, what's wrong with me?
And
that's something else you've got to conquer to get to an even playing field.
Yeah, it does become a self-fulfilling prophecy for some kids, right? And it takes a really long time for them to kind of get over that. If you are growing with adults around you constantly telling you that you're bad, you do start internalizing and you start believing it. And that was something that the writer had to overcome in order to become successful in her own life.
Yeah, my son got suspended like 6 times in preschool.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're white.
Well, he must have been really bad.
Well, I mean, look, because if a kid bites another kid and he's hitting adults and stuff, I mean, I've been thrown off a plane with a 3.5-year-old because,
oh, really?
because he was saying, the plane is going to crash. And he was screaming it like before takeoff. And they're like, get off the plane.
He's 3.5.
Doesn't matter.
But maybe he knows something. The plane. He looked out the window and saw a gremlin.
Well, what he said was the plane was going to hit the sun and melt. So he didn't know that much.
Right. Close call.
Have they ever had a 3.5-year-old? Of course he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's 3.5. So there's two issues here that Anna alluded to and Wes is building on here, right? One is the issue of discrimination, and I think that's really interesting. The other is the over-criminalizing of kids, yes. Right? I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's me. I don't know any 3-year-olds who don't throw a temper tantrum at some point. Yeah. My 3-year-old's super calm, and every once in a while, he'll get mad because he's 3. Yeah. And, you know, Bob, I don't do that. And boom, he hits you, right? I'm not going to suspend him from my house.
They have to overreach and overreact, and then they learn based on how you treat them in response to that.
Right.
And also, really fast, the only point I really want to make about this is that we talk about racism constantly on this program, and all too often the stories that we have, that the media talks about, that we respond to, are like old, like dyed-in-the-wool, as you would say, conservatives, sort of explicit racism and stuff like that. In the teachers, especially like preschool and elementary school teachers, and the young college females in the study that you cited, neither of those demographically are likely to be incredibly conservative groups. A lot of them probably libs who are just as susceptible to these sorts of implicit subconscious forms of racism that they don't know that they still harbor. So even libs watching this program should be on the lookout for ways that they judge other groups that they don't even know that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Everybody does it.
Everyone.
I do
absolutely.
It. Everyone does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Try not to.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. No, with the obvious exception of me. But other than you. Everyone else does.
Everyone else.
Right.
The Department of Justice's report on police abuses of power in Ferguson, Missouri, continues to reveal damning details of the ways that both the police and the courts have routinely abused both their power and the people living in Ferguson. And they've identified two, apparently, principal motivators for that abuse. Earlier this week, we revealed the extremely racist emails that have been routinely passed around both by the police and by the courts. And we've got more for you, and they are shocking. We also find out that money was one of the key motivators for a systematic abuse of power in pretty much every facet of Ferguson life. The report found that city police and court officials have worked in concert to maximize revenue at every stage of the enforcement process for several years. City and police leadership pressure officers to write citations independent of any public safety need and rely on citation productivity to fund the city budget. Many officers have no tools for de-escalating emotionally charged scenes, and they themselves routinely dismissed parking tickets for their friends, colleagues, and acquaintances. So on the one hand, they are attempting to give as many tickets and fines and fees as possible, and in some cases, as we'll show you, locking individuals in Ferguson into a cycle that they effectively cannot leave, where they are paying fees for the rest of their life, giving out crazy amounts of citations. We've heard that in a city of 16,000 people, in some years, they've had 9,000 or 10,000 arrest warrants in this community of 16,000 people.
Yeah, I have to jump in on this point. This is not unique to Ferguson. Mm-hmm. This is right. Something that's happening throughout the entire country. It's a form of regressive taxation. This is what happens when you don't have the rich pay their fair share of taxes, right? All of a sudden, you have to come up with the revenue. And what do? You start having people pay more money to park their cars on the street. You start issuing more citations. You basically go after the middle class and the working class. It's not unique to Ferguson. It's a disgusting way to make up revenue.
Yeah.
So a couple of examples. They have internal emails where they brag about, we raised more revenue by giving out more fines and traffic tickets, but to the right people, not to the wrong people. Because as John read to you, and that's part of that is so frustrating. When it comes to their friends, colleagues, and acquaintances, they're off scot-free. Yeah. They don't even pay the fine, let alone the interest that they put on the fines, let alone the arrest that they make off the fines, et cetera. No, they get none. I mean, the thing is, if you are the beneficiary of this, you might know if, you know, your friend in the police department got rid of a traffic ticket for you. But what you might not know is if you never got the traffic ticket in the first place, right? And what you certainly don't know is the experience of the people who did get those tickets. And you think, traffic ticket, what's the big deal? Well, this one woman who's not a wealthy person at all, she's an African-American woman in that neighborhood. gets multiple citations on one violation in a parking garage. She gets a $151 fine. That's already a bit devastating. It's devastating almost for anybody, right? Mm. That's a big number. So she has trouble paying. She tries to pay it throughout.
Homeless from time to time.
Right.
Well.
Yeah. But she makes an earnest effort. She tries to give $25 one time, another time $50 as to begin to pay off her. The court says, no, I don't want it. It's a partial payment. You're not. It's a technicality. You're not allowed to take partial payments. But then what they do is they start fining her more and more because they're saying, well, now you're not paying it. But she's like, but I tried. So it winds up that she's already paid $550, okay, on the original $151. Jeez. But they say she still owes $541. The debt is endless, and it gets worse. She's been arrested twice. She spent 6 days in jail. And then what job opportunities does she have after that? Yeah. You've been arrested. You spent time in jail. The government's still trying to track you down to get the extra $550, which you never owned in the first place. And this is how they systematically crush and oppress people. But you never see it because you're not in that neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you turn around and you go, what racism, man? We elected Obama. What are they still complaining about? This is what they're complaining about.
But it gets worse than that, right? So when you have a police force that goes after these people and continuously antagonizes them, then you can't turn around and look at this community and say to them, why aren't you complying with cops immediately? It's because they don't trust cops, right? So you can't expect them to comply 100% when A, oftentimes they do comply and they're brutalized anyway, and B, they're brutalized before they're even in any type of trouble. They're being targeted by the cops in these cases.
Yeah. So there's a specific example of that too. And as the writer here points out, you should go read the report. I know most people obviously won't, but it's a case study in how not just minorities, but poor people are oppressed in this country. So a guy goes out and plays basketball, comes back from basketball, cop comes by and accuses him of being a pedophile. He's like, what the hell are you talking about? Oh, you're by a playground. He's like, I know. I just played basketball there. Are you ignoring my orders? Get out of the car. Okay? And you're dangerous. But I'm not armed. Oh, I think you might be. I'm going to search you. I'm going to do a pat down. And I'm going to search your car. Now, when you go through that experience, I mean, if it happened to, let's say, a guy who's a Second Amendment advocate, and he's got a gun on the car, and the cops want to question his gun, he'd be furious, right? Yeah, right? But in this case, the guy doesn't even have a gun. He just got done playing basketball. So one of my points here is, how often have you played basketball? Me, thousands of times. And I never got bothered outside a park, right? Nobody ever came to pat me down and accused me of being a pedophile out of the blue, right? So I don't know that I'm avoiding that discrimination. I don't know that that's what he's got to deal with his whole life. So to Anna's point, that's why they don't trust them, because they have excellent reason not to trust the police, because the police have been haranguing them, unduly targeting them, and bringing them to prison and all these things unjustly for years and decades on. You think the Michael Brown protests sprung out of just one incident?
Yeah.
No, it sparks a flame because already people knew that they were being crushed. And that's what this Department of Justice investigation shows. And that's why it's so valuable. Just please try to learn from it so we can do better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's disappointing is how long it took for the Department of Justice to actually investigate this kind of thing. Remember, it reminds me of the predatory banking practices. Remember how, you know, until they passed the new law, then if you were late for one, like, $2 charge for coffee, then you got a $39 charge on top of that on your credit card. And then they would continue to charge on top of it so that somebody would end up paying thousands of dollars in fines and fees because that was the nature of this predatory banking. And now this is essentially predatory policing, you know. They're not just using it to fund the work of the finances of the city and the municipality. They're also using it to sort of keep these people from actually being able to get beyond these fees. Yeah. And it's, like you said, it has devastating consequences in people's lives. I mean, the guy that was pulled over at the after playing basketball, he lost his job. You won't be able to get a job after that. So it actually keeps these people in poverty.
And one of the charges, by the way, that made him lose his job is when the cop asked him his name, he said, my name's Mike. But because his name is technically Michael on his ID, they charged him with fraud. That was one of the charges against him.
These are made-up charges.
And understand something. That guy was a federal contractor. That means he'd already been approved by the government. He's got a job as a federal contractor. And he lost it because he told the cop his name was Mike. When it is Mike, right? And if you get targeted like that, if that happened to you day in, day out, you wouldn't be skeptical of the cops? So I need you to open your mind and understand that perhaps they have a different perspective than you. It's not that I'm telling you cops come and oppress you in your neighborhood. I'm telling you that's happening and you're not seeing it. You're not. Yeah. But they do see it because that's their perspective. This is a slow motion Jim Crow. And so we never got rid of it. And so, you know, Anna mentioned the 9,000 warrants on cases in 2013 alone. Just on the fines and fees, not 9,000 warrants overall, just on these traffic violations, these citations, etc. And they joke around in the emails like, ha ha, we raised more revenue from them. And so they cut taxes on the rich, and then they raise revenue in this way. They even talk about how they can't remove certain judges, even though they know that the judge is not fair, because they can't slow down revenue. And that judge gives out more and more citations, and he keeps that money coming, right or wrong, just or unjust. They don't care. This is the system that oppresses people in this country. And again, yes, it happens to minorities disproportionately, but it also happens to the poor across the board, all across the country, no matter what the race is. And so we got to change this. If we don't change this, then we're not living in the same country. I mean, we're back to a situation where we have lords. Right. Who rule us. And this is, and to them, I guess they think it's a joke because that's what they do in the emails, whether it's racist emails or in the emails where they talk about we raised more revenue from them. We knew there were more sales tax cuts coming for us, so we raised revenue from them. It's grotesque.
So we continually spotlight cases from around the country that sort of demonstrate this pattern. And there are certainly other outlets that have done it. I mean, it took until Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and those sorts of cases for them to be willing to do it. But this should be, like, the biggest issue. If you are a traditional conservative, if you're a traditional libertarian, and you talk about freedom, like, they bring up bullshit examples of how people lose their freedoms in this country. But imagine living in what is effectively a low-grade North Korea, where everything you do is criminalized. Even sitting outside of a park is a criminal act. How can you say that these people are in any meaningful way free when everything about their life, they're just seen as walking wallets that the government can take money from? If you look at a cop the wrong way, if you say the wrong thing to a cop, you have absolutely no freedom, and they don't care at all about it. Because for the most part, the people don't look like them or the people that they spend time with.
If your manner of walking down the street bothers the cop, then the cop can give you a ticket, according to this.
That's
by the way, what happened to Michael Brown? His manner of walking down the street bothered Officer Wilson, and he eventually shot him in the head.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And it's also an enormous case of projection. When they say, oh, class warfare, and all the Democrats want to do is take money from our class and give it to the other class, they're projecting because that's what they've been doing. Yeah. They've been doing class warfare, except they're doing it on the most powerless people in the country.
Mugging the poor. They're mugging the working class.
That's exactly right, man. We got to get up and we got to fight back.
Did you know that the UBC Bookstore collects food for the AMS Food Bank? If you would like to contribute, please bring your non-perishable food items to the bookstore and drop them off in the box near the front cash area. For more information, check out ams.ubc.ca under services.
The president today, I think, these are such important comments, they bear repeating, and I know that there's a bunch of you on hold, and I will get to your calls in just a second, but I just want to play these two clips from President Obama one more time, because they are so touching and so to the point. And the first was President Obama saying what I've been saying on this program for some time now, particularly since the verdict came out in the trial, which is that, I mean, he's not saying it the way I'm saying it, but I mean, speaking to this point, shall we say, that both Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman were on trial. George Zimmerman was on trial for killing Trayvon Martin, and his defense was that Trayvon Martin was a bad guy threatening him. So then the sub-trial of that was that Trayvon Martin was on trial. Was he guilty of threatening George Zimmerman? Now, if he was guilty of threatening George Zimmerman, then George Zimmerman had a legitimate self-defense defense. But if Trayvon Martin was not guilty of threatening George Zimmerman, then George Zimmerman had no defense. So both of them were on trial, but the standard that was used to judge George Zimmerman was, did he feel frightened for his own bodily safety? And if he did, then he had the right to pull the trigger and kill this kid. The standard that was used for Trayvon Martin, just ask any right-winger in America, the standard that was used for Trayvon Martin was, why didn't he run? It was the pre-2006, pre-Koch Brothers, NRA, Alec, Jeb Bush, pre-stand your ground, shoot first law. That was the standard that was used for Trayvon Martin. They, you know, the right-wingers keep saying, why didn't he run? He had 4 minutes. He could have gotten home during that time. So Trayvon Martin did not have a right to stand his ground. George Zimmerman did, by that logic. And I keep pointing this out, and people keep going, really? Well, here's the president pointing it out.
I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws.
Yeah, we might want to. Yeah, in 31 states, we have stand your ground, shoot first laws put there by the National Rifle Association, the Koch brothers, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they're virtually always Republican toadies. And it's time to seriously examine those laws, number one. And number two, he said, by the way, you white people out there who have never had much contact with African Americans, you should know that life is different for us than it is for you. The president, I mean, again, I'm paraphrasing. You'll hear his actual quote in just a minute. But I keep saying on this program, and I've been saying it for a long, long time, I didn't know what white privilege was until well into my adult life. I don't think most white people understand what white privilege is. And I don't think most white people have any idea what the experience of being black in America is. And so the president did some educating today, and I think it was really important that white people in America hear this. Now, I realize that there was an explosion of white right-wingers hysterical about this. Hugh Hewitt, this POTUS presser is remarkable, like he fell through the time tunnel to his state senate days. And Republican Brian Walsh, remarkable that the president of the United States continues to fan the flames on George Zimmerman. And Joe Pollack writes at Breitbart.com, Obama backs the race baiters. And Joe Walsh, President Obama's making this all about race. And Dana Loesch, it's a combo protest diversion from scandals and attempt to weaken laws protecting the right to self-defense. And Tammy Bruce and Ben Shapiro and Dan Rea. There's a whole list of all these tweets from all these right-wingers over at thinkprogress.org. But, you know, who are objecting to the fact that he's saying, hey, by the way, you white people, and by no coincidence, I don't think all these people who are attacking him are white. He says, by the way, you white people, those of us who grew up black and male in America have a slightly different experience of the world. Here's his saying that.
You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often.
So there you go. The president's saying, this is, you know, welcome to my world. Pretty amazing. I think that, frankly, those simple comments are some of the best comments on race in America that I've heard in a long, long time.
Listeners know I'm a big fan of analogies. I recognize they are all totally imperfect, but I think they are good learning tools. So if after all of that, you still have even an inkling of a question as to why we say Black Lives Matter instead of All Lives Matter, or if you know, but you'd like another tool in your tool belt to help educate other people, then here's an analogy that went sort of viral on Reddit because it seems to be educating a lot of people on this. It's getting through to people who could not be gotten through to otherwise. So here's the analogy. Imagine that you're sitting down to dinner with your family, and while everyone else gets a serving of the meal, you don't get any. So you say, I should get my fair share. And as a direct response to this, your dad corrects you, saying, everyone should get their fair share. Now, that's a wonderful sentiment. Indeed, everyone should. And that was kind of your point in the first place, that you should be part of everyone, and you should get your fair share also. However, Dad's smart-ass comment just dismissed you and didn't solve the problem that you still hadn't gotten any. The problem is that the statement, I should get my fair share, had an implicit too at the end of it. I should get my fair share too, just like everyone else. But your dad's response treated your statement as though you meant, only I should get my fair share, which clearly was not your intention. As a result, his statement that everyone should get their fair share, while true, only served to ignore the problem you were trying to point out. That's the situation with the Black Lives Matter movement. Culture, laws, the art, religion, and everyone else repeatedly suggest that all lives should matter. Clearly, that is a message that already abounds in our society. The problem is that, in practice, the world doesn't work that way.
To the girl on Facebook who commented hashtag All Lives Matter after deeming the protest she attended a hateful event Martin Luther King would have been ashamed of, call it an overreaction, call it a riot, a violent protest, call it everything but justified. Ask us to be polite, to stay calm, to voice grief with respect while our brothers' bodies are laid out on the street, sounding the alarm. Our bodies are threats well before they are human, and you still want to know the source of our rage. You fear our rage will happen across a storefront window, will happen across a corporate office. You fear the glass shards glittering under police helicopters. We fear your rage will drag our children into the streets and dance in the red pool beaming under street lamps. I cannot decorate this pain for you. I cannot make a beautiful homage. I can't invoke hope in prayer. I don't know how to make you understand the occupation your ignorance has blinded you to. That black bodies are stopped and frisked so often, we might as well call our cities war zones. Every street corner a checkpoint. Violence is not always a dead body. Violence can be a pat-down in broad daylight because you share the same hue as suspect violence is indicting the man who filmed the killing of Eric Garner, but not the officer that illegally choked the life out of his body while five others assisted in the arrest. Violence is convincing a jury that he caused his own death, that had he not been overweight, he would have survived. Violence is needing six officers to arrest one unarmed, nonviolent man in the first place. How can we accept a government that only applies the law to fill prisons with black bodies? How can we accept a government that permits and perpetuates violence against its people, The state traded white hoods for police uniforms. The cops kill more black people each year than the KKK lynched. And you want our marches peaceful. You want us calm. You want us quiet. Stop asking us to bite our tongues when we cannot guarantee our siblings safe passage to the corner store. Yet you still want to talk about looting. Want to police our protest tactics. You want me to know that you would have cared about the tombstones this nation is hoarding if we hadn't blocked traffic. You think stopping trains is silly. You want us to march peacefully. To replicate your disfigured perception of Martin, but Dr. King said, riots are the voices of the unheard, and you will hear us now. It is not enough for you to hold our dead in your prayers, to wish us love and light. I get the sentiment, but it won't keep my kin from becoming ghosts. I am not interested in resignations or remorse. I don't want apologies. I don't want your guilt. I don't want your tears. I don't want insistence on how not racist you are. I don't want to know how many black friends you have when you won't even risk the discomfort of calling out your own classmates. You just don't get it, do you? You've never lived out the aftermath. The empty seat at the dinner table. The now widowed mother with six mouths to feed. My kin are being sent to heaven well before God has requested their return. And you want to know why Malcolm called whiteness the devil. You can say all lives matter. But all lives are not killed every 28 hours. All lives will matter when black lives matter. How many more bodies will be enough evidence? How many videos of our last words? How many more must there be for you to finally call this a genocide? Black lives matter.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless...